Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. With growing attention to the apparent fact that Russia hacked the emails of the Democratic Party and Clinton campaign chair John Podesta, here's a question about journalism. Should news organizations refuse to publish leaked information if it comes from a foreign country trying to influence our elections? In the Times, long article on the hacks yesterday, one line said, quote, every major publication, including the Times, published multiple stories citing DNC and Podesta emails posted by WikiLeaks, becoming a de facto instrument of Russian intelligence. Neera Tanden, Clinton ally and president of the Center for American Progress, was among those whose emails were published. She told the Times for their article, what was really surprising to me, I could not believe that reporters were covering it. So let's take on that question. Should news organizations refuse to publish leaked information if it comes from a foreign country trying to influence our elections? Eric Lipton, one of the Times reporters with a byline on yesterday's article called Hacking the Democrats, joins us. And also with us is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi, David and Eric. Thanks so much for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great to join you.
Thank you.
Eric, that's a heavy thing to write in the Times, that every major publication, including the Times, became a de facto instrument of Russian intelligence. Do you feel like the Times and the American media in general were played?
I think that it's a difficult question that doesn't have a simple answer, and I think that at minimum it's something that newspapers need to be discussing and coming up with the better answers to. And I realize that I didn't really answer your question, but I could give you a longer one.
Well, go ahead. You want to give me another layer on that?
I mean, it's basically a tension between two imperatives. The first imperative is to report news that has news value, and the second is to not become an accomplice to a crime. And so the problem is when you're faced with a situation in which, you know, I could certainly illustrate it with the Sony hack, which is another very similar situation. North Korea had hacked into the Sony email and computer system after a film that disturbed the leadership in North Korea. That was a mock film suggesting that literally assassinating the leader of North Korea, and then they hacked into the system there. After that, I saw emails that had come out of Sony that showed that the film executives were collectively working to try to influence the Mississippi state attorney general to try to get him to do subpoenas and to investigate Google because it was not doing enough to crack down on sort of bootlegging of movies that were on the internet. And that was really interesting because they were talking about making contributions to the Mississippi attorney general to try to influence him, and they actually drafted a subpoena that they wanted him to send to Google to get information from Google as they were trying to go after Google because they thought it was essentially allowing their intellectual property to be stolen. So that was fascinating, and it seemed like that was really important. But at the New York Times, we were like, well, we're not going to use the Sony emails because they were stolen by a foreign government as a way to try to humiliate Sony. And so what do you do in that situation? I mean, the film industry was trying to use its clout to influence, and they'd hired the former Mississippi attorney general to lobby his successor, and they were making contributions to the Mississippi attorney general, and they'd written a draft subpoena for him. And then he issued that subpoena to Google. So, wow, how do we not write that?
And you did or did not write that?
I did. I wrote that story.
Yeah.
Even though the New York Times policy at that point was we should stay away from using the Sony emails. So what we did in that situation was we tried not to quote from the emails, but we relied upon the content. Now, that was pretty substantive. Some of the stuff in the Clinton emails, the Podesta emails, that is, there was some gossipy stuff that I don't think you can justify doing gossipy stuff. There was the text of the speeches she gave to the Wall Street banks that made headlines. I mean, you know, can you justify that? I don't know. I mean, but can you justify any of it? I don't really know the answer to this. I think it's a really difficult question.
So, David, I'll turn to you, but I also want to open up the phones for listeners, and in this case, invite journalists in particular on this question. Should news organizations refuse to publish leaked information if it comes from a foreign country trying to influence our elections or government policies. Or Eric Lipton from The Times just gave the example of the Sony emails, which adds another wrinkle. Should news organizations ever refuse to publish information they consider to be in the public interest because the source was too tainted in any way? 212-433-WNYC. Members of the public who are consumers of journalism, certainly invited to weigh in. But I'd love to get some journalists yourselves who've thought about this. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. So, David Folkenflik, as an NPR media reporter, have you considered this question of are there ever times when we should weigh the source against the value of their information and decide not to publish or broadcast?
Well, I think this issue has cropped up increasingly because there's it's so much easier to obtain information that's digitally transmitted when people are willing to hack into it. And let's pause for just a quick sec and give Eric Lipton and David Sanger and Scott Shane credit for not pulling their punches in that passage you read at the top of the hour. You know, I think that, that the Times, as well as other news organizations, has had to make difficult choices. And I think people can rightly question whether the right choices were always made. Eric said that it's not right to get into gossipy stuff. Certainly at the Sony hacks, you saw a lot of exploration of one of the top executives' shopping habits on Amazon. That's not justifiable in any way, but it was sort of voyeuristic and fun for the readership of that online publication, and yet, you know, not really justifiable. On the other hand, we also learned that Jennifer Lawrence and Amy Adams were paid considerably less by Sony than their co-stars in a major award-winning picture than their male co-stars. Even though they were all four, seen as top line stars.
That's not gossip. That's a public issue, right?
Yeah, that was a valid exploration of gender discrimination, even at women who are among the most famous people in the world. If you think about the New York Times, this isn't the first time that New York Times has had to think about it. Think about WikiLeaks, call it 6-7 years ago, when it was deciding to try to obliterate the ability of the U.S. government and the military to, as I put it at the time, to smother the circulation of closely held secrets. You know, they were trying to expose classified information about the way in which the war was waged in Afghanistan by the U.S., and it was done despite the adamant objections of the Obama administration. The Times and The Guardian and in Germany Der Spiegel, respected publications all, essentially collaborated, although that word was something that then executive editor Bill Keller rejected. But they basically collaborated with WikiLeaks in doing that back then. They felt the information was of fundamental public interest. They felt they were careful to redact information that might harm, sources and methods of U.S. intelligence and the like. But, this is complicated, problematic stuff, and it's led to the present day where you don't just have a non-governmental, somewhat anarchic actor like WikiLeaks, or if you think of Edward Snowden, who saw himself as a whistleblowing contractor from the NSA, revealing incredible secrets about the way in which digital communications were monitored by the U.S. government. This is of stuff that is obtained, in. I'm not saying the journalistic outlets broke the law in doing this, but clearly those that obtained the information broke the law and, would be prosecuted if they could be reached by federal authorities. So these are really tough decisions. We are now in some ways at the crux of the debate, which is not there's somebody who wants to embarrass the government. There's somebody who wants to do things in conflict with the government. There's somebody who actually in some ways wants to manipulate the electoral process itself, even if, as the Times has suggested in its reporting, it's not clear that the Russians expected the candidate that they seem to be helping to actually end up in the White House. So I think these are real important issues for news organizations to be very clear about. They're going to have to make very fine gradations. I do think Hillary Clinton's speeches were newsworthy. And yet if you looked at the journalistic and chattering classes on social media, on Twitter in particular, as some of this stuff played out, even as they acknowledged some of the intellectual complications with taking this stuff from hacks, they were gleefully sort of getting into the weeds of, who was sniping it, how much it resembled high school. And even as they were saying, don't take your eye off the ball, so much of the journalistic attention was focused to the high school-like gossip.
Yeah.
And so much was taken away from what's being done to the Democrats here, one of our two major parties.
But when you deconstruct it along the lines of the content, what was gossipy and what was substantively newsworthy, that gets away from the question of the source. So Would you guys agree as a principle that if the information is of public value, short of threatening someone's physical safety, let's say, because I know there are times that the Times, for example, won't publish if there's a national security threat in something that's leaked. But other than that, there's almost no time when the source would make the difference if it's true, relevant information to the public interest. Eric, is that a fair statement or a principle, or is that too simplistic?
No, I mean, I'm not prepared now to accept that as a principle because, I mean, I'm really torn about this, and I just need to think about it more, and I haven't – I mean, I just don't want to become an accomplice. But at the same time, I mean, another problem is, say, you know, some particular news organization takes a principled stand and says we won't use it. But then, you know, there are so many other news organizations that use it. So what is the principled organization accomplishing by not using it? You know, because you've it's still in the public domain. The, you know, it's so. But I don't know. I mean, I think, okay, at a minimum, In the Russian hacking situation, Guccifer 2, which was essentially a front, if we are to believe this whole, you know, plot, and as described by the intelligence services, and I'm pretty convinced that this is what really happened, if we are to believe it, Guccifer 2 is a Russian front. Guccifer 2 was offering individual reporters the opportunity to get caches of documents that he or it had not made public. And he essentially set up a Twitter direct messaging function where you could tweet message to Guccifer 2 and get, like, Florida House District race documents in particular races. And individual people, including a Republican lobbyist from Florida who had a blog, requested documents and then did damage to House candidates. I mean, that is taking it to an even different level, where you're selectively getting stuff that is not already public, and in some cases you're getting it in password-protected places. And so to me, in that situation, you are becoming a co-conspirator almost. I mean, you're not just – stuff hasn't been dumped into the public domain and you're debating whether or not to use it. I think that to actually be engaging with the person who has stolen the stuff and then mm-hmm. – you know, now, okay, so then you go back to Edward Snowden and WikiLeaks. I mean, so then you could say, okay, did the New York Times do that? Because, you know, the stuff was shared exclusively initially with the Times, right? Yeah. So, I mean, what am I saying? Here I am saying we shouldn't be doing that.
Yeah.
So, it's a very difficult – I mean, what I know is that we're in a period of transformation when it comes to this. I mean, just the amount of material that's coming forward through these venues is enormous, and it's not going to go away. But I don't know what the answer is right now. Sorry.
David, what do you want to add to that? The idea of that possible principle, the way I laid it out there, that the source really doesn't matter, shouldn't matter to a news organization if they have true, relevant information to the public interest that doesn't threaten anybody's physical safety?
I say never say never, but I think I'm not going to embrace a blanket policy in the way you framed it. Let me say a couple of things. First off, Eric says, you know, and I appreciate the anguish that I'm hearing as he thinks this through out loud. I respect it very much. Because the Times itself has benefited, as it did during the Pentagon Papers, from leaks. But, you know, that was a clear-cut case of a whistleblower about a specific thing about the history of the Vietnam War, of course. In this case, you know, I don't think it's fair to say, well, it's out in other places and therefore, you know, what are you going to do? This is not merely a competitive question. This is a question of, you know, what does the Times stand for? What does the Washington Post stand for? And I think even if things are available in other places, it does matter if you have to make conscious choices, and those choices actually influence others, particularly when they're made by institutions like the Times and the Post and major networks and the like, even in this age with so many other outlets. You may have to deal with the blowback from disclosures, but, you know, you don't have to necessarily engage it in fully. Excuse me. I think also, you know, you do have to in some ways consider the source and the context. If you're thinking about this Snowden issue, which certainly was controversial across the ideological spectrum in terms of what was released into public. And yet, you know, even President Obama, who thinks that Snowden should come back and face charges, has said that Snowden served a public service in making clear what was being done in the public's name, but behind very closed doors. This is different because you have essentially an asymmetrical situation. We accept in the press, all of us, all kinds of information from all kinds of actors all the time. Not all of them reside in nunneries. Not all of them are Nobel laureates or perfectly pristine people. And that's okay. We got to evaluate the information, really check it, particularly considering the source we get it from, and that's part of the game. In this case, when you have essentially somebody able to strip one party naked in public, or one candidate naked in public, and it's completely asymmetrical, what happens is that by default, the sheer volume of coverage and of revelations are utterly weighed to one side rather than the other. And I know Donald Trump and his supporters will say, hey, there was a lot of critical information and coverage of Donald Trump throughout the race. And that's true, but that's because he never really received this kind of scrutiny. He's never stood for public office before, much less held it. In this case, what happened to Hillary Clinton and the Democrats was, you know, every dependent clause was stripped bare and dissected in public by major news organizations. And even if the revelations themselves, as I believe, were not that big by and large, that they were largely of a political nature rather than a truly scandalous nature, I think that it ultimately completely diverted the course of coverage and even the course of the way the campaign was able to operate.
On the other hand, there was so much criticism of Trump as unfit after the leaked videotape of him with Billy Bush on the Access Hollywood bus, right, which came out actually on the same day as the first of these Podesta emails.
Yeah,
and the Billy Bush tape was a bigger story.
That was a leak, though. That leak is different than something stolen. That was someone – I mean, when someone leaks something, you don't have the same problems as when someone steals something. This is not a crime when someone leaks something. So I don't think that the ethical debate is parallel.
You know, but let's be clear. We, you know, the press, including the New York Times, has the ability to say, rightly, you know, that case law suggests that if we receive something that we did not commission to be stolen, that we did not encourage to be stolen, but that if we receive something obtained by that person illegally, but who just hands it to us, if there's a public interest, you know, we are not breaking the law in order to publish it and or broadcast it. And, you know, I do think that the context, the newsworthiness matters. You know, even if the source is a foreign government who wants no good for the U.S., there are times where there are foreign actors who have things that cast light on how our public officials, how our military, how our, you know, other people acting in our name behave, and sometimes in problematic ways that we should probably know about. And at the same time, in this instance, I think it highlights the ability, when you have an intense effort to hack the complete inside communications of one political actor or agency or figure in an election, and is willing to dole it out, you know, day by day, week by week, and as Eric and his colleagues have chronicled, apparently, you know, race by house race, essentially the press is responding quick twitch to stimuli completely outside its own control. And it's different than saying there's a story as opposed to saying there's a campaign that's being covered on this basis. If you understand what I'm saying, it's just there's a different nature that ensues, and I think it's ultimately subverting of the press being able to think independently, particularly at an age when all of its competitors, and Eric kind of alluded to this, are able to publish instantly online, and therefore you have an even greater imperative and pressure, seemingly, to try to go match it or supersede it.
David Folkenflik, NPR media correspondent, and Eric Lipton, New York Times investigative reporter. As we ask the question, should news organizations refuse to publish leaked information if it comes from a foreign country trying to influence our election, or if it's stolen? Eric, go ahead.
A short point, and then we can, you know, turn the conversation a bit. But I think that the answer is that there can be no standard policy, because this is way too complicated for a standard policy. I think it has to be case by case. And the minimum standard has to be that you only use stolen material if there is a legitimate news value to it, that you only even consider using it. And then after you pass the test that it has real news value, then you decide whether or not it's too much of you becoming a tool to an interested party, and you are just executing on their plot, or the news value is great enough that you have no choice but to serve the public interest by writing about it. I think that, and then each case has to be evaluated on that standard. That would be my sense.
Podesta and others on the Clinton team continue to go on political TV shows, but mostly refuse to comment on the content of the emails, claiming that they weren't going to spend time verifying the accuracy of something stolen by Russia and given to WikiLeaks. Here's one example. Podesta on Fox News Sunday on October 9th.
I think we should take a step back and say how we got here, which is that the Russians, as the U.S. senior members of the U.S. government confirmed, have been hacking into Democratic accounts, and now they've hacked into my account. They put out documents that are purported to be from my account. But I think if you look at what she said in this campaign, to get to your question, I would just add, you know, this should be of concern to everyone that the Russians are trying to influence our election.
And really, David, we had two parallel stories from that point on. A, the Russians are trying to influence our elections, and of course, the story to this day. And B, oh, look what they uncovered.
That's right. I mean, look, I participated in it to the extent that I believe one of the things we learned from these emails was that Donna Brazile, while being a paid pundit for CNN, cable news network, also and vice chairwoman at that time of the Democratic Party, had been in some ways passing along information to the Clinton camp about the kinds of questions that she might receive. And there's some ambiguity about how much she got into the CNN
debates.
Yeah, that's right. How much she got into CNN's thinkings in the primaries, you know, that she may have been passing along things that weren't from inside CNN. But nonetheless, it showed a kind of collusion from somebody being paid by CNN theoretically to educate the public. It seemed to me that this was highlighting something I've talked about in the past, which is that it seems to me, in a sense, a corruption of journalism to have somebody who's so senior a party official also being paid by a news organization for her punditry. It seemed to me, who do you think she's serving there? The Democratic Party or your viewers? It obviously her party allegiances come first in every instance, and that helped lead to her dismissal or departure from CNN. But, you know, it also, you know, that was from those hacked things. I made sure to say these were, emails said to be hacked by the Russians and passed through WikiLeaks before being posted publicly. And at the same time, it seemed to me newsworthy, but also problematic in terms of how it came about. And in retrospect, it seemed to me sort of a very partisan thing. Yes, John Podesta. Yes, Donna Brazile. Yes, all these people say, you know, in response to any question, you know, that is something that was illegally hacked by the Russians and posted by WikiLeaks to damage Democrats. We're not going to respond to it. In retrospect, I actually have a lot more respect and a regard for that response. I understand it. I think it makes sense.
Eric, I know you got to go in a minute. Do you have time for one more question?
Okay. Yes, go ahead.
Since you've looked so deeply into the hacks and their origins, let me play you two quick clips. These are like 12 seconds each, of Russia expert Stephen Cohen, Princeton professor emeritus, on this show yesterday. He's generally seen as a defender of Putin. Here's one.
We've had other secretaries of state who have had we've had other presidents who had potential conflicts of interest. That's the job of the voters and the Senate to explore, but not the loose allegations that somehow he's pro-profit, not pro-Putin.
Sorry, that was on Rex Tillerson. Here's the one I was thinking of.
Now we have this hacking story for which there are, as yet, no public facts. And what's happened is the whole discourse about Russia in Washington has turned into a kind of hysteria.
And?
The question of what facts we have for hacking, we will not know until they're actually presented. So far, including in this endlessly long, it must be 15,000 words in the Times today, no actual facts are presented.
So that was your article he was referring to, Eric.
Okay, let me start off by saying it was 7,200 words, so he's got his facts wrong. So maybe he should check his facts before he speaks on the radio. And secondly, I mean, you know, we spoke to a lot of cyber security experts, and there is agreement across the board in the intelligence community, and there's agreement among every publicly spoken member of Congress, with the exception, you know, in the government, with the exception of Donald Trump, that there were Russian actors involved in this hack. So the malware that they used has specific attributes that have previously been identified and attributed to Russian actors, and you know, again, so I think that the question as to whether or not they were trying to influence the specific outcome of the election is open to debate. I think that's a valid debate. Did they necessarily want, you know, Donald Trump to win over Hillary Clinton? I don't think that's conclusively decided. But whether or not there were Russian actors involved in this, from everything I've been told from people that, you know, that I at this point trust, it's conclusive. So I do think that there's a need for an independent investigation. I don't think there should be an investigation by a House or Senate committee. There should be an independent commission appointed that has subpoena power, that has an executive oversight, you know, by someone that's appointed who has, you know, is
independent,
that the public has trust in. Because if you leave it in the hands of a partisan committee, you know, then it will not be a truly independent investigation. I think that the only way, I think this is important enough, and the threat to American democracy, not only in this election but potentially in future elections, is significant enough that there needs to be a very thorough and public vetting of what exactly happened here, which actors were involved, and what the appropriate response is. And the only way that will be done is through an independent commission.
Eric, thanks for your reporting, and thanks so much for being willing to come on and talk about it today.
Thank you.
Eric Lipton, New York Times investigative reporter and NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik is going to stay with us for a few minutes and take some of your calls. Rob in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Rob, thank you for calling in.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I'm a journalist myself and an editor and have worked with WikiLeaks stuff in the past. And I think that this conversation is right on track. There's no simple answer, but it certainly has to be this question of how high is the bar for the news value of the stuff you're using, especially when by using it you become a pawn of the Russian government. And a lot of stuff is a lot of stuff that comes out of leaks. Sony is an example. You know, the Sony stuff, there were lots of bad examples of basically salacious gossip that was being used. And I think in the election, what happened, what we have to grapple with is that a lot of the stuff that came out of the emails was just on the order of, let's write about sort of snarky infighting in the Clinton campaign. And that ended up really kind of dominating the news cycle at various points when other things should have been dominating the news cycle, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Rob, thank you very much. And I think everybody agreed about the unnewsworthiness of some of the things that got a lot of attention. Robert in Manhattan Valley, you're on WNYC. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Brian. Brian, I'm an attorney here in New York, and I've sometimes worked with journalists and investigative reporters. To me, this is all an issue about, A, editorial standards as to verifying the source of the material, the sources, and also, to some extent, as it impacts the publication and the publisher, a legal standard. And the question really, and it's too bad the Times investigative reporter didn't stay on the line, or having, let's say, David Leonard or an editor mm-hmm. talk about editorial ethics mm-hmm. and standards. So, you know, when we look back on these articles, I think the initial reports, very initial reports, didn't talk about the Where is WikiLeaks getting this? Where's the source of this? You know, and in the face of the, let's say, the principal, either the Democratic National Committee or the Clinton campaign not commenting. So then how do you go about as you know, as a publication of note like the Times or the Post, determining for yourself, what is the source of this? How'd they get it? Was it hacked? Was it illegal? Don't we owe our readers a discussion of that up front?
Right.
And then as you determine, hey, it's illegal. It's illegal information. It's spying. It's a provocation coming out with that in real time against we are now many months later.
Yeah.
But at the time. So
right. And Robert, I'm going to leave it there for time. And David, there was, as we heard in the Podesta clip, which was from right after the first Podesta emails came out, there was this context that was provided, at least by mainstream respectable news organizations, that this did apparently come from Russian hacks and was apparently stolen, even as the information was being discussed. So what would you say to Robert or the first caller?
In many ways, it's now clear that the bigger story was the hack rather than what the hack found, right? And there was reporting about that in the time, and some news organizations were careful to be clear about where information that they were reporting, even on the Democratic Party, came from. But it's not clear to me that the press really understood how big a story it was.
Scott?
And it's not
Go ahead. Sorry.
I'm sorry. I'm just saying, and it's not clear to me that the press really did its job. I think that we keep getting, in some ways, pulled hither and yon by each new development in this digital age that surprises us. And we are sort of figuring it out in real time and often falling quite short. And we say, well, we'll never make that mistake again. But it's not that you're presented with that same exact set of circumstances again. It's that you get the next iteration, sort of analogous next generation thing. And on the fly, I think in this immediate age, it's really difficult to make these decisions as so much information is available to us about so many things in new and different ways.
Scott in Red Bank, you're on WNYC. Thanks so much for calling, Scott. Hi.
Hi, Brian. I think it's important that there's an independent commission to get to the bottom to make sure that there's, you know, I'm positive that it was Russians that hacked. I believe the press with that. And I'm a little alarmed as a Trump voter and supporter that he kind of is downplaying that part of it. But as far as the influence on the election, that is so overrated to me and getting way too much coverage in itself of that, of it having any influence on the election. All the voters I know, the people I know, it had no influence. World leaders and countries all try to influence the election, maybe not like with the hacks, obviously. Mm-hmm. But I mean, we tried to influence Brexit, told them that, hey, if you don't vote for it, you're going to get to the back of the queue. You know, I mean, countries all have their interests in trying to influence elections. We try to do it with other countries. Other countries try to do it with us. That's getting way overplayed in my mind.
And so you're saying
And another excuse and almost a way to delegitimize his win in some way. I don't like that at all.
Scott, so you're saying as a Trump voter, other Trump voters you know and yourself, this was really not near the top of the list for why you made that decision.
Not at all. It's so far down. Even the whole email thing before the hacks came out was so far down on the list. It had so much to do more with jobs and the type of jobs that are out there and that economic feeling of loss and not doing as good as our parents did and our kids not going to be able to do as good as even we are. That was just so much more important to all the Trump voters than the Clinton email stuff. And, I mean, her reputation has been sealed for 20 years. That stuff didn't change anybody's mind in my eyes at all. And I can't find a single person who it did change their mind.
Scott, thank you. I appreciate your call. David, what about that? There is, from a media perspective, also a political twist on this from the Democratic side, which is that they are using this information, legitimate though it seems to be, about Russia's influence in these hacks or Russia being behind them. That, you know, there's a subtext here of, well, this somehow makes the election of Trump less legitimate, makes his taking office less legitimate, that the Democrats are trying to use.
Well, look,
when it's not really the basis on which very many people voted.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little hard to disentangle and do the experiment in reverse and isolation and take this all away, right? We don't know what the Clinton campaign would have been able to do or not do in some of these key states had they been so inclined if they were not having to deal with this on a daily basis. It seems as though, you know, people who are analyzing the polls such as they are, people like Nate Silver, say that the Comey announcements about the fact that, well, there are these new emails discovered on Anthony Weiner's laptop and we've got to look at that. That had not been turned over, perhaps involving the email server scandal, just reignited all the concerns about the emails and that may have had more of a direct effect. But, you know, this was not a one-day story or a big hit. This was sort of the accretion of attention being diverted for weeks and months about this stuff. And it clearly threw the Clinton camp off their game. They just didn't know what they were going to do from the reporting from Eric Lipton and his colleagues, as well as other reporting that has played out since those hacks occurred and those information started being doled out publicly. So I find it hard to disentangle. I think that the caller's probably right. But I don't think that we get to say, well, it's a problem if a foreign government, which works to undercut our interests frequently abroad, hacks into our stuff but wasn't particularly effective at changing the election. That's not what the integrity of the election's about. You know, the integrity of the election is, you know, do we feel that foreign powers are actively working on domestic soil to undermine a party's stability? These are, you know, we currently have effectively a two-party system, and one of the two parties was unraveling as a result of hacks that the New York Times is seemingly credibly reporting, joined by the Washington Post, in saying was directed by the highest levels of the Russian government.
And of course,
I don't know. You know, that would, if the roles were reversed, you know, I think Republicans would rightly say this is something Democrats need to join us in being outraged on. You've heard that from several senators from the Republican side. We'll see whether or not more join them.
And the caller is also right, isn't he, to suggest that our outrage is kind of selective because we're outraged when Russia does it to try to influence our elections. But the United States has such a long history of influencing other countries' elections from, you know, the CIA being involved in coups overturned in Iran and Chile in past decades and, you know, getting involved. Maybe what he said was right with respect to Brexit, you know, messages from our government directly or indirectly if your government.
Well, let's hold on there a sec, though. I think that, you know, if you're looking at the American history over the past the century, you know, it's almost like a globetrotting tour where you'd have one of those old valises or trunks with stickers from countries all over in every continent across the world. If you're looking at government officials making remarks publicly about things that are playing out in foreign countries, that's, you know, that's part of public discourse. You know, whether Republican or Democrat, it seems to me that that's okay. Like I'd like to know what my leaders think about Brexit. Mm-hmm. I'm okay with that. I'm okay if that information bleeds over the Atlantic. That's kind of how such public diplomacy works. That's okay. The question is whether, you know, in violation of the law, you know, foreign governments are in this case hacking into one party's servers. It turns out possibly both. But what it does with one party's is to turn it over to WikiLeaks and get that stuff all made public and Guccifer and the like. You know, that is an attempt to not put a thumb on a scale but put an anvil on the scale. And the real intent, it seems to me from reading this, is disruption, not was to land Trump in the Oval Office but to just completely cause discord in one of the major two parties of this country. I think it's legitimate to say that's of concern regardless of who you voted for and regardless of what party you belong to or how you feel about whether some of the stories were newsworthy. It's still – that is a huge story and it's – you know, I was talking about this with colleagues a couple of days ago and the Times went right at this. Think about, you know, in the lead of its story yesterday, think about what this was occasioned by. It was a break-in at Democratic National Committee headquarters, which is really what started to unravel the Nixon administration.
Yep.
Was the break-in at the Watergate. You know, this is a fundamental problem if these major political entities can't have the integrity of their operations, even if some stories arise which are indisputably newsworthy.
It's the 2016 virtual edition of a break-in at a major party headquarters. David Folkenflik, media correspondent for NPR. Thanks a lot.
You bet.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Congressman Gerald Nadler next. Stay with us.